Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Annette Smith. She's Executive Director of Vermonters for a Clean Environment, an organization she co-founded 15 years ago with Vermont citizens when a large energy project was proposed for a region. After successfully defeating that project, Annette has worked with Vermonters throughout the state to defeat large quarries, landfills, farms, and other large energy proposals while also improving Vermont's groundwater protection laws. Annette has lived off-grid with solar in Vermont for more than 20 years, hand milks a cow, has a flock of chickens, grows most of her own food, including citrus in a greenhouse, and seeks change through collaboration when possible and opposition when necessary. So thank you so much for your work, and thank you for being on this program.
Well, Derek, thank you very much for having me on the show.
Well, thanks. Okay, so let's dive right in. And, you know, we hear all the time that first off, the world, as we know, is being drawn and quartered. And we always hear that one of the solutions to this is that wind energy is somehow going to save the day and slow global warming and do all sorts of other really great things. So do you believe that wind energy will save the planet and address climate change?
Well, about 10 years ago, I did believe that it would. I really thought that, you know, it's a free source of energy. It looks pretty. And then in 5 years ago, I got asked to actually get involved in a project that was located in a few towns over from where I live. And I started to do research. And the more that I learned, the less convinced I was that wind energy was going to save the planet. At this point, after 5 years of this, I am absolutely convinced that it is one of the great scams of our time and is contributing to energy sprawl the same as natural gas fracking and is really carving up the earth and fragmenting yet more habitat that we can't afford to lose.
I don't know that I've heard the phrase energy sprawl before. Can you tell us about that?
Well, there's a very good book that is in coffee table book, big color format, put out recently. It's called Energy, and a Vermonter named Tom Butler is the editor of it, and it really puts into perspective energy sprawl. So page after page after page of natural gas fracking wells, of tar sands oil, of ridgeline wind development, of solar fields in inappropriate places. And we see over and over that it's just more, 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 more. It's all about development, and it's not solving our problems. Nobody's saying no to fossil fuel extraction while we are encouraging renewables. We just, the all of the above attitude is destroying our planet.
So what are some of the specific problems, both locally and globally, with wind energy?
Well, the first problem that I have observed more and more recently is what an unethical business it is. So very much like the what we used to call the gas guys 15 years ago when I first started working on the natural gas pipeline and power plant proposal for the region, we joked that they must put something in natural gas to make people lie. And the wind developers, many of them actually have come from Enron, and that whole industry has developed out of the whole wind industry has developed out of the natural gas industry. In fact, the most recent head of the American Wind Energy Association came directly from the gas association, their lobbyist. They lie. That's a big problem. So the wind developers come into your community, they say, we're here to save the planet and get excited because you get to be part of the solution. And they make all kinds of promises that it's going to power so many thousand homes and it's going to displace this much in terms of carbon dioxide. They don't offer any evidence of any of this. You're just supposed to believe. And a certain number of people do believe. But then when the projects are up and running and there are problems, and some of the biggest problems have to do with the noise and also the killing of birds and bats, then they don't admit any problems ever exists. I've never seen an industry that has no problems and everything is always wonderful. And it is consistent from developer to developer, so there is no accountability. And that's a huge problem. I used to say that the top issue was how these wind proposals divide our community. And so that's now second on my list. The wind developers come in and they really by necessity have to try and encourage pro-wind groups because they don't form naturally. They're, you know, this is an issue where the more people learn, the more opposed they become. And so there are always opposition groups that form. And so then they try and trump up proponent groups. We've heard of meetings where they have told people, we'll write the letters to the editor for you to sign. They generally appeal to people who want to see a break in their taxes. And so in the end, what we've seen happen, certainly in Vermont over the last 5 years, is that as more and more of their myths get busted, all they have left is money. And so now they just kind of start out with, we're going to give your town $500,000. Well, some people in town want that. And some people say, we're not for sale. And so then that pits neighbor against neighbor and family member against family member. And it's a very ugly business. And there is no middle ground. So we like to try and work on collaborative solutions that build community. And we've asked 5 wind developers, please do it differently. Please work in a community-based stakeholder process so that the citizens don't have to spend their own money to hire experts that compete with your experts, the dueling expert syndrome. But instead, the wind companies know that if they pay their own experts, then the experts will say what they want them to say. One person I know who's a wildlife expert calls those types biostitutes. They can be paid to say whatever the wind companies want them to say. And then the other side hires experts that come up with something else. And that's just it's not an effective way to go about evaluating the impacts. So I even attended a program at Harvard Law School a couple of years ago that was sponsored by the Department of Energy. I was very suspicious when I went into it. I thought it was going to be really geared towards pushing wind because it was called Facilitating Wind Energy Development. You had to apply to get in. There were about 100 of us in the room. About 30 of them were wind developers. About 30 were regulators from various New England states. And about 30 of them were from communities in New England who wanted to see wind developed. And so we got a wonderful education from Lawrence Susskind, who is the founder of Harvard Law School's Alternative Dispute Resolution Program. And it was all about community-based stakeholder processes. And the undercurrent was that the Department of Energy has a goal of, or they did have a goal of 30% renewables by 2030. And they saw that there was no way under the current way that it was being done that these goals were going to be met. And so they wanted to educate the wind developers about how to do it differently. And we still have yet to see a single one of them who's even willing to talk about it.
Let's back up a second. And can you talk in more specifics about some of the environmental harm caused, not by the production of wind energy, although the windmills. If you want to talk about rare earths and all that, you can. But I'd really want you to focus on some of the local effects, local harmful effects, whether it's noise, bat kill, bird kill, habitat fragmentation, and so on, associated with putting in wind energy on a locality.
Well, in Vermont, I think what we're seeing, and in the other New England states, is a real extreme. You know, in the Midwest, you drive into a field, you clear the field, you dig a hole, you pour concrete, you put in rebar, you erect a turbine. In Vermont, you first have to build a road to the top of the mountain. So we have seen 2.5 mile long road built into a pristine habitat. They say they use existing logging roads to somehow make that better, But it turns out these roads require tremendous quantities of dynamite to blast the roadway, which in several cases, in fact, were not existing logging roads. The quantities of dynamite used for these projects has been truly shocking to people. In one case, the Lowell Wind Project, it's 21 3.3 megawatt turbines that are 459 feet tall, Vestas turbines. They said at the preliminary meetings that they would be using about 750,000 pounds of explosives. Now, based on the blasting levels that we saw, and we heard that some of the locals said that they did some 30,000 pound blasts, and I've worked on quarry issues, so I know that in some quarries in Vermont, that's how much they use in a year. That they probably, we could estimate they use probably about 1 million pounds of explosives. Now, the explosives are ANFO, ammonium nitrate, fuel oil. And the formula is, for 1 million pounds of explosives, that requires 9,000 gallons of fuel oil to be mixed with the ammonium nitrate and then drilled into and blast and injected into the ground, which in Vermont, the ground is our groundwater sources, our mountains. So the mountains act like catchments that collect the rain. And so these mountains play a critical role in, and these are the areas where there are the purest water resources. Now, that's one of the aspects of the impacts on the environment that the wind industry has tried to make a distinction about. We don't use water. Look, all the water that's used in coal, nuclear, natural gas, and fossil fuel power plants, we don't use water. Well, when you put these things up on mountains in Vermont, you are affecting the headwaters, you are affecting the groundwater, you are creating an exposed rock with all the blasting that then heats up. So what was a cool forested mountain that provided cover for the wildlife and breeding habitat is now turned into essentially a large quarry on top of the mountain with all this rock, this exposed rock, which results in heating up the water. So these headwater streams that are the home for the aquatic life and depend on the cool water temperatures now are having dramatically increased water flows and water temperatures, and it's increasing the stormwater runoff because you have much more impervious surface. So as we look at the changing climate, where these mountains contain critical values for the forests, for the wildlife and the water, those values are exactly the things that we need to protect, yet they're being destroyed. So that the water issue is one that it took me a while to come around to, because I'd worked on water issues for just about everything I've ever been involved in, but it took a while to realize, oh my, the wind issue is probably one of the biggest threats. And a year or so ago, I heard a radio program where West Virginia naturalists were talking about, of course, mountaintop removal, and that's what we hear in Vermont. Well, if you don't want wind, then what? You support mountaintop coal mining. Well, they said that they view ridgeline wind developments as second only to mountaintop removal in terms of threat to water resources. And that's certainly what I have seen in the work we've done in Vermont. So then you add on to that, okay, you're blasting away these mountaintop ridgelines, you're increasing stormwater runoff, you are ultimately, by having all these exposed areas, increasing the temperature of the water, you're increasing the potential for the area to have less groundwater recharge, so degrading the quantity over time. And then there are all these interior forests where the birds nest, and those are now being degraded. It opens it up to other types of species that come in. These mountains are critical for the migration of wildlife, especially as the climate changes. And so there are localized fragmentation issues, and then there are the connectivity issues where the wildlife need to get long distances, north, south, east, west. And so you add on top of that the noise that comes off of these machines that, the wildlife will come up and browse around it, but their habitat, the creatures that need to live in those areas are then, displaced. And it's not like they're moving somewhere else. It's just they don't have anywhere else to go. We've heard that a lot in around many of these mountains, they're now down much lower, moose, deer, bear. It's just, their home is gone. And then there are the migratory issues, the birds and bats that are killed by these. And with all of these issues, it's the fox guarding the hen house. So the companies that build these, the regulators allow them to choose the experts. The experts come in and they do the studies. The studies are essentially rigged in advance, so you never get any credible research out of it. And we have had many scientists in Vermont come together and form a group, an ad hoc group called Peak Keepers. They have a website, peakkeepers.org, and they have held roundtable discussions to discuss these concerns about how, for instance, if you were going to do this right with good science, you would be setting up a collaborative effort, perhaps using students at a university, to really look at before what are the conditions and then after how are those conditions changing. And none of that is being done. So we're not seeing any good science being done around any of this. The companies control the site. The companies control the expertise. And so there's no trust and no credibility in what is being produced as a result of the reports coming out of it.
Given everything you're saying, why do so many good people support wind energy without knowing anything about the issue? And, I mean, in other words, why are people willing to believe and accept that it's the answer to climate change without really needing any evidence?
Well, I'll tell you, after 5 years, that's really been a big puzzle to me. And I keep trying to find people who do believe that wind energy is going to make a difference to have that conversation, because I don't get it. And it's very disturbing. I've been doing this work in Vermont for 15 years. And so I know a lot of good people who, when you approach them, and a number of people have done this, they've written to these legislators, for instance, and they have shared the answers with me. And the answers tend to be, well, we don't have time to waste. We have to do something. Maybe it's not a big difference, but it is some sort of a difference, and we have to do everything we can as quickly as we can. Now, that, to me, doesn't really answer the question. And the best answer that I've come up with over the years...
there's all this talk about renewable energy, in theory, to save the environment. And I think that's great. But unfortunately, using wind...
I look at that wind as it's here. Why?
All right. So, sorry about that. The best answer that I found actually comes from a 19th century book called Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. Are you familiar with that?
I've heard the name.
It's by Charles Mackay, and it has different chapters on things like the tulip mania. And there's one line in it, one quote in it, that I think kind of answers the question better than any sort of rational intellectual thing. In reading the history of nations, we find that, like individuals, they have their whims and their peculiarities, their seasons of excitement and recklessness. When they care not what they do, we find that whole communities suddenly fix their minds upon one object and go mad in its pursuit, that millions of people become simultaneously impressed with one delusion and run after it till their attention is caught by some new folly more captivating than the first. So these spinning, beautiful sculptures have captured people's imagination. There has been a tremendous lobbying effort by the wind industry. I don't know if you've noticed your, U.S. mail postage cancellation has a row of wind turbines on it. It's been going on for a year. I think it's finally ended. You see ads on TV. For years in the Vermont legislature, actually, the legislators walked around with little wind turbines. So there's been an indoctrination that's happened. And, since back around 2002, 2003, I thought I believed in wind energy. I went to visit the existing project in Vermont the Searsburg project. At the time it was put up in 1998, I thought the turbines were beautiful. I didn't have any issue with them. Well, it turns out they were 197 feet tall. Now it's being put up. We have three different sites in Vermont. They're 420 feet tall in one site, 430 in another site, 459 in another site. We've seen proposals for 492-foot tall turbines, and now we're seeing the U.S. government is giving out grants for what they call low wind situations. In New England, all of New England's sites are low wind, and those turbines are somewhere between 500 and 600 feet tall. And so it's just kind of gotten out of control. Meanwhile, I think most of us would consider Vermont to have probably the best congressional delegation. We have Bernie Sanders, Patrick Leahy, and Peter Welch as our congressman. We have a liberal Democrat governor, Peter Shumlin. You really cannot have a conversation with any of them about the problems with wind energy. Every single one of them is aware of what's going on in our Vermont communities with people unable to sleep, desperate, some desperate to leave their homes because of getting sick. And their response is, well, that's a state issue. Or their the governor's response is that our hair's on fire and we have to do something about climate change. And we don't have time to have the discussion. And that to me is really, it's troubling. And we see our governor out getting some national attention and talking about our community values and local control. And then we see absolutely none of it actually taking place, where here we have an opportunity in our small communities in Vermont to do real community renewable energy and do it right and do it in collaboration with the people who live here. And we are not, it's being done completely backwards and upside down and building tremendous opposition to renewable energy because of how it's being done. And I wish somebody could explain to me, other than this popular delusion and the madness of crowds, why it is that such good people have been unwilling to think really about the costs and benefits, and especially in a state like Vermont, where we have this image of our pristine, beautiful mountains and our peaceful, quiet, rural small town communities, why people are so willing to make this sacrifice without any evidence. It is very, sort of, I guess, symbolic of how insane our society has become.
Yeah, you know, as you've been talking, I keep thinking about, really, I guess in some ways, the central image of a lot of my work is that the problems we face are not fundamentally rational, and so they're not, therefore, not amenable to rational solutions.
Basically, yeah.
The culture's crazy.
I use the word insanity a lot.
Yeah. Go ahead, sorry.
Because that's just, there doesn't seem to be any rational thinking going on. And those of us who are cursed with thinking logically and rationally and wanting to do research and make sure we're making the right decisions and who really care. I mean, I care so passionately about the planet and having clean water and improving our systems. Yet we're the people who are the sort of the enemy of the state and seen as opposing things rather than as working towards solutions. It is very insane.
I think part of the problem, at least for me, is that I keep thinking about what all the so-called solutions to global warming have in common, which is they all take industrial capitalism as a given, and the natural world is that which must conform to industrial capitalism, and how that's crazy in terms of being out of touch with physical reality, because without a planet, you don't have anything. And the planet should be first, always. And I keep thinking about, oh, here's another line that always comes to me, and you can just respond to any of these or none of these or whatever you want. There's a great line by Upton Sinclair, and I'm sorry for the sexism. It's hard to make a man understand something when the job depends on him not understanding it. And that makes me think of a line by George Monbiot right after Fukushima came, you know, Fukushima, that whole catastrophe. He said that Fukushima made him even more a proponent of nuclear energy. And part of what he said was, this is pretty close to a direct quote, how else are we going to get the energy we need to run our brick factory?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought if we just change a couple words, it'll change everything. Which is, instead of how are we going to get the energy we need to run our brick factory, how are the capitalists going to get the energy they need to run their brick factory? And it seems to me that that's part of the question too, is what do we in our communities really want as opposed to what are the needs of industrial capitalism?
There's another good quote from John Trudell. I'm not looking to overthrow the American government. The corporate state already has. I mean, that is where we are. I happen to have just taken a little break. I was away for 4 days and for a variety of circumstances found myself in the Hamptons on Long Island. And it was very interesting to drive around these multi-million dollar mansion areas. And my friend and I observed that the larger the house, the less occupied it was. And the smaller the house, the more it looked like people lived there. Well, I got home and I got to thinking about just what's the energy consumption of all those pools and tennis courts and swimming pool and, you know, the houses that have all of their heat on and that nobody's living there. And these people are probably not living there. They probably also have a place in Vermont and they're probably spending the winter in the Caribbean. And meanwhile, I'm struggling and have been struggling in this one case around wind to find a home for a family of four. I've been working with this family for 2 years. They're sick. They have two small children. They're desperate to leave their homes. Everyone in the highest levels of government is aware of what's going on with them. And I cannot find a way to get them a new home. And yet here are all these empty mansions that people aren't living in. And how do we make this systemic change from the excess of those who have too much and those who don't have anything and are actually being oppressed by those who are making so much money? It was a really fascinating experience to be sort of plunged in this neighborhood of excess.
So this all takes us back to the question that you were, the issue that you were talking about earlier about community self-determination. What would you like to see happen specifically regarding the issues that we're talking about having to do with wind energy or anything else? How would you like to see short term that process change? And you can talk about longer term, bigger changes you think are necessary too. But in the short term, what would make you reasonably happy concerning these processes, concerning the attempts to put in large-scale wind energy projects in Vermont?
Well, I think in the short term, what we've seen that has truly failed is the citizenry sort of having the role of speaking to regulators, speaking to politicians and elected officials, and asking for help or asking to participate in something. And I think what we need is to have a table where everybody's sitting around the table and have an equal seat at the table. So it's more a matter of rearranging the furniture and by doing that, changing the dynamic of how we approach things. So we have seen a complete failure of our regulatory system and of our political system to successfully move forward with renewable energy in a way that works. I think I can say after 5 years of working on the wind issue in Vermont that we have pretty successfully shut it down. Now, does that make me happy? Well, I mean, I do believe that we need to get off of fossil fuels and we need a different energy system. However, in the grand scheme of things, this wind turbine technology is simply an inappropriate technology for not only Vermont, but New England. And I really, as I've researched over 5 years, the question of whether or not it is saving fossil fuels and reducing greenhouse gas emissions, I do not think it is. And that's the core issue that I have really tried to understand. So every wind turbine and all the wind turbine projects are and how they can address climate change are a function of the system in which they're embedded. So in New England, we have the independent system operator. And in the New England grid, we've already displaced most of the coal and oil that wind turbines can displace. But now what we have to displace is natural gas. And we have natural gas plants that are the what they call the ramping plants. So when the wind blows, then there are natural gas plants that then are asked to reduce their output. Well, those plants do not run efficiently when they're dialed back, when they're ramped back. And so it's sort of like driving in traffic. Instead of just cruising along at one speed on the highway, which is more efficient if you're driving 55, you're asking it to stop or slow down and then start again. And so we may actually be increasing fossil fuel emissions. We probably are saving some fossil fuels, but not very much. And we need to install a whole new set of peaking generators, which are very expensive, but are designed to ramp efficiently. So there's a huge amount of money that has to be spent in addition to the extremely expensive wind turbines. Then you have to get the transmission grid upgraded to be able to handle the electricity to move it to the population centers. And then you have to completely change over the generation fleet to ramp efficiently. So you're talking billions and billions of dollars. And where's that going to come from? Right now, the reason that wind energy is cost effective in New England is entirely because of the production tax credits. And so the Senate Finance Committee just added that back in, and they're trying to get the production tax credits extended once again. And that is death to the people and the mountains around here if that goes through, because without that, it is not an economically viable business. So this idea that we can do something constructive with this particular design of wind turbine, just the more I look at it, the more it kind of falls apart. So what would it look like to do renewable energy the right way in New England? Well, solar is our best resource. And now I'm dismayed to say that we're seeing solar being done the wrong way too. I've lived off grid with solar for 20 years. I want to see solar panels on everybody's roofs. But no, what are they doing? Well, we have, again, a subsidy system that is encouraging outside developers to come in. They're leasing fields. The majority of the fields, that the sites that I've looked at where they're proposing these, and they're generally about 2-megawatt projects, are full of wetlands. They are on ag soils, and in some cases they're increasingly in neighborhoods. So you have the glare issues, you have the hum and the fans from the inverters, and they're not putting them on the built landscape. They're not putting them on roofs. They're not putting them in parking lots, and they're doing it where it's cheap. And I understand it is extremely lucrative, the same as the wind energy business. It is very profitable for a few people. So we're now having to get involved in trying to help neighbors of solar projects have a say in what goes on in their community and fight even to have a seat at the table, knowing in advance that the policies that are in place by the legislature will rubber stamp everything that the developers propose, because we have to build everything as quickly as possible. And what we'd like to see happen is for the developers and the state regulators and the policies that are coming out of the legislature to respect our communities, support them. We have a lot of town energy committees. We have systems in place to enable the people to come together and look at our community, look at what the needs are, and then figure out where the right places are, and primarily because solar is our biggest resource, to prudently site solar in a way that works, and hopefully come up with a wind resource or a wind technology that people can live with. And we sure don't have that right now.
Let's talk. We have about 8 or 9 minutes left. I wanted to ask you real quickly about Denmark, even though that's a big jump. You know, we hear a lot of times that Denmark is cited as this tremendous success story for wind energy. But can you tell me about some of the opposition groups in Denmark to wind energy?
Right. And we've seen a lot of Danish, like, people come and speak, like, at the Renewable Energy Vermont annual conference over the last few years and touting what a wonderful, experience Denmark is having. It's been a difficult subject to, really understand because of the language issues, but we recently had someone come forward who is fluent in Danish. And so he's been researching it for us, and he's found that there are like 190 wind opposition groups. The same thing that happened there that's happened here in a slightly different way. Most of the turbines that are up in Denmark are actually smaller than a megawatt. They're more the size that we have at Seersberg, where, you know, people, I think that's what people think of when they think of wind energy. These relatively small, they don't have to have lights on them. And over time, what's happened in Denmark is that they have used up all of the easy places. They have made the turbines bigger and bigger and bigger. And so they're going into more natural areas closer to where people live. And the same health effects are happening. So the health effects that are happening there and are happening all over the world are that people get headaches. They get sleep. They get their sleep disturbed. It's not just the audible noise. These turbines produce infrasound and they pressurize the air. And so you have entire areas in Denmark now that have so many of these big turbines around them that you cannot escape this barometric pressure wave that's coming off these. And I've been finding visualizations of what it looks like to help people understand that. Imagine vortexing waves of energy coming off, and it hits your house, it turns your house into something like a drum. And so the pulsating rhythmic, like water torture, womp, 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 gets into your heart, it gets into your system, it raises blood pressure. You wake up in the middle of the night having a panic attack. People get sent to the hospital for racing hearts. You get nauseous because it's like seasickness because the air is pressurized, like you're riding a wave. And so that's happening now even more in the areas in Denmark and Germany, these previous success stories where they are finding that people can't live with them. So there's real tragedy taking place around these wind turbines all over the world, Ontario, Australia. It's the same story everywhere. And in every case, the elected officials are not listening. And so the Danish are having the same fight that we're having here in Vermont, that's going on in Maine. And the story is hidden a little bit by the language barrier, but it is very real and it's a sad story.
Well, this is a story that just gets played out so many times in so many different ways, whether it's this or GMOs or pesticides, that it's always the same story, nuclear energy. It's always the same story where they tell us all the benefits and they hide all of the downside to it.
Well, what we've realized in Vermont through developing a tremendous network throughout the state is that we do have a lot of power. And what we're trying to figure out now is how to mobilize that power in a way that isn't just, you know, the people going out in the streets and protesting and saying, you know, we want our leaders to change. But our system has failed. Our democratic system, our political system has truly failed us. And so we need to find new systems and make our own way. And I'm a little bit hopeful that is, you know, maybe things have to get so much worse before they can get better. I think that we can't do it with the existing technologies. I think we need to encourage and really pray for some more advanced ways that don't involve like burning things and destroying things in order to create energy. And we need to use less. We need to really stop this overconsumption that especially we're doing in the West. And, you know, how many toys do people need? How many houses do people need? And I think this is a painful transition, but this also goes to the concentration of wealth in the hands of a few. So from my perspective, this focus like on CO2 and climate change, in a way, I think is the wrong focus. I think that the focus really needs to be about how the 99% of us who are being turned into slaves as part of this fossil fuel economy need to regain our Earth. And I'm seeing that through all of these issues, whether it's GMOs or in agriculture, petrochemicals, pharmaceuticals, that if there is one thing that we could do to heal this Earth, it is to grow hemp. And we can completely change our economy by having a hemp-based economy where we have pharmaceuticals, we have paper, we have energy, all based on the beauty of what is hemp, which is quite a shift, I realize, in the conversation. But it's something that is really important to understand what happened back around the time that the automobile was developed. Ford was developing it for using hemp as the fuel. He made a whole car out of hemp. He envisioned industrial hemp as the basis for our industrial society. And instead, we ended up with 1938 and Reefer Madness and the fossil fuel consortium taking over. And so we're in a place where if we can lift the veil of the fossil fuel industry and embrace the growing and production of hemp, we really can heal this Earth.
Okay, this is all really good and really interesting. So what we're basically down to one question, and you know, people listen to this interview, and then I guess two things. One is, if they live in your region, is there contact information, or is there website they can go to? And then also, if they don't live in the region, or if they do, what do you want people to do now that they've heard this interview?
Well, if they live in Vermont, they can, if they want to contact me, our website is vce.org, as in Vermont, Vermonters for a Clean Environment.org. If you want to know more about wind energy, we set up a place for people to get information. It's vermontwind.info. Also the scientists' website, peatkeepers.org. There's an organization set up in Vermont called Energize Vermont that looks at the various renewable energy options and looks at solutions that are in harmony with our environment. In terms of what people outside of the region can do, I would say that a single message is, promote hemp growing, and let's find a way to shift away from asking our politicians to solve our problems for us and really work within our communities that are doing better on local food production to embrace more local energy production and really research hemp. Look at what, for instance, John Trudell is doing right now, talking about hemp saving the earth. And we really can make these changes and our system shift, I think, much more rapidly than many people may think.
Okay, well, thank you so much for being on the program today. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Annette Smith. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
Thank you, Derek.
So thank you so much, Annette. I hope you have a great day. So,
you too. And for your cold, there's something called Bronchial Soothe. It's ivy leaf extract.
Uh-huh.
And I just Google it. It's really great stuff.
Okay.
The last time I had a cold, I couldn't believe what a wonderful substance it was. It turns out it's very popular in Europe.
Okay, well, it's called Bronchial Soothe?
Bronchial Soothe, S-O-O-T-H-E, and it comes in pills or a liquid. I tried the liquid, and it didn't, the cold didn't go into my chest, and it actually really felt good, and it just was a miracle thing.
Okay, I will look for that right now.
Good.
Okay, I hope you have a great day.
Thanks, Derek, so much. You're doing great work, and I so appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. You are, too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Have a good day. Bye.